Back in 2005, real estate developer Andrew Kissel was arrested, accused of stealing more than $30 million from his investors.
Kissel scammed banks, investors, neighbors.
A year later, just days before he was about to plead guilty, Kissel was found brutally murdered.
American expatriate Nancy Ann Kissel was convicted of the murder of her husband, 40-year-old investment banker Robert Peter Kissel.
It was the question of was she or was she not an abused spouse?
We know Nancy and Robert Kissel because of the milkshake murder.
Two incredibly successful brothers, but suffering the same tragic fate.
Hey, true crime besties, welcome back to an all-new episode of Serialistly. Hey everybody, welcome back to an all-new episode of Serialistly with me, your true crime bestie, Annie Elise. Now, the case we're talking about today, I don't want to say that it's a throwback one, but I've never talked about it on this channel, on my podcast, on my YouTube channel. I've never talked about it anywhere. And it's one that I remember when I was first getting into true crime, I was really curious about because there are elements of like extreme wealth, deceit, affairs, I mean, siblings fighting, all sorts of stuff. And if I'm remembering correctly, and I think I am, I think there was even a Lifetime movie made about it. I'll have to double check. I'm pretty positive there was. But anyway, it was one that always just like piqued my curiosity because it had all of the elements of just insanity and also kind of like making yourself question like who would ever do this when you literally have the entire world at your fingertips, the means that of to do anything you want in the world. And it's just wild. I feel like some of those are the more fascinating cases even sometimes to me just because there's just such an element of mystery of like what would drive somebody psychologically to do things like this when they seemingly have everything they could possibly ever want in the world.
He stole money. That was something that he didn't seem able to control.
Because she won't survive.
And I called his attorney and I said, we have a problem here.
So I know I was getting a little bit ahead of myself there. I apologize for that. But let me just rewind and take us all back to more of our time, like of our youth, our childhood, our teenage years. Because if you ever grew up with either a sibling, maybe a cousin, or even somebody who was just close in age to you and you were with all the time, you probably know what I'm talking about when I say that sometimes there was an element of rivalry, right? Not just sibling rivalry, but just even with your peers where it's who's gonna race to the finish line and get there first. I know with my son and my daughter, it's always, you know, me first, this and that. And there's just like, you know, a little bit of healthy competition. And it's kind of natural, especially when you're younger, whether it's your sibling, your best friend, or your cousin, or whomever it is. It seems like that's something that everybody goes through a little bit in their childhood. But the common thread in all of it is that it's never, never ending. You know, you grow up, you grow out of it, and you kind of move on from that. Although sometimes when you get older, if you're somebody where those little games don't stop, they could sort of shift a little bit, where maybe all of a sudden it's not about who can run to the end of the block the fastest or who was the first to call shotgun and sit in the front seat, but it's more on a larger scale, you know, who's doing better in life, who got into the better college, who has the bigger house, who earns the most money, whose Instagram has the most followers or shows the most picture-perfect family. Those kinds of things where you're constantly comparing yourself to that close person in your life. Now, like I said, obviously this isn't how it works for everyone. Not all family or close friend relationships are full of rivalry or any sort of competition. Some people really do just get along with their siblings and their close friends. But so far as Andrew and Robert Kissel were concerned, their whole relationship really was about competition and truly about trying to outdo one another. Now, when they were growing up, Andrew and Robert both spent some time in Saddle River, New Jersey, which that's a high income and very peaceful area, which is only about 25 miles outside of New York City. They also had a younger sister named Jane, and their father, he was a successful businessman. He always pushed the two of them to be as great as they could possibly be, you know, great at everything they did. Kind of almost like a Menendez brothers type dynamic, if you get what I'm saying. Like, less all the sexual assault allegations, of course, but just really like it drove them to be the absolute top tier best they possibly could be. And some might say that he even pushed them a little bit too much. But you know how it is, right? Parents want the best for their kids. And if you are in an extremely high wealth type of situation, sometimes those parents drive and ride their kids a little bit harder, wanting them to not just leech off the successes of their parents, but really make a name for themselves as well. So the point is that in all of that, and whether it was too harsh or not, the father's lessons always stuck with the brothers. They were never okay just saying that they had done something good enough or that it was all right or okay. They always felt like they could do better, and they always felt like they should have done more too. They always wanted more as well, which I have to say is pretty ironic when you really step back and think about it, because Robert and Andrew grew up fairly wealthy, as I mentioned. They never really wanted for anything in life. They didn't need any more money to keep living this stable and comfortable life. They already had it. Yet they still felt, for whatever reason, like they didn't have enough. They weren't rich enough. They weren't respected enough. The people who knew them weren't impressed enough. They also felt like they had to be in competition with one another. Sure, Andrew and Robert loved each other, but Andrew always wanted to be better than Robert, and Robert always wanted to be better than Andrew. And this wasn't limited. This was at everything. Now, Andrew was the oldest, and it's safe to assume that he especially felt a lot of pressure to be the best and, you know, to always really succeed and be the top brother. He didn't want his little brother to be showing him up. But the thing is, stuff didn't come as easily for him as it did for Robert. And sometimes it felt like Andrew could work twice as hard and for twice as long just for Robert to then come in and do better than him without even breaking a sweat over it. Robert was just naturally charming too. I mean, he was charismatic, he was smart, he knew how to talk to people, how to, you know, what do they say, like grease the elbows or like grease the wheel? I don't know what the expression is, you get what I'm saying? But like he always knew how to like chat people up and get in their good graces and grease the wheels. That's what I mean? Is that what I mean? I don't know. But he was just really good at talking with people. He was good at skiing. He was just charming and smart and really kind of everything that Andrew felt like he lacked.
Skiing was basically everything for them. And Rob was an amazing skier. It seemed that whatever Rob did, he did it well. They were competitive. Who could go faster? Who could jump the highest moguls?
So Andrew, on the other hand, he wasn't as outgoing as Robert, and he didn't have all of his ducks in a row like his little brother did. However, he did have one thing going for him. Like I mentioned before, he was older than Robert, and by a couple of years. So this meant that while Robert was still in school, Andrew was able to get a head start in life. He was able to start his own business. And maybe by doing that, he could make his fortune before Robert even had a chance to, you know, get going, get off the ground floor. And he did start a few businesses, in fact, until he found his true calling, which was real estate. Now, right off the bat, he was able to use all of his family's wealth and connections to, like, drive right into the deep end of this. He didn't have to work his way up from little sales to big sales. I mean, he started out pretty much right at the top right away. He was buying and selling these huge buildings all over the East Coast. I mean, call it nepotism, if you will, or just family connections. I don't know. But he definitely wasn't starting with like fixer-uppers or foreclosures or doing anything like that. Like, he went right out of the gate strong. And on the surface, it seemed like he was really good at it and really enjoyed it. He was making money hand over fist to all appearances and just like crushing it. Now, as for Robert, he wound up in investment banking. He also worked for top tier companies like Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, just kind of a lot of big heavy players in the space as well. And his job, it took him all over the world, visiting a bunch of different countries. So much so that at one point, he and his wife Nancy ended up settling down in Hong Kong. And their place in Hong Kong was gorgeous. They lived there with their kids. This place had three pools. It was just like they had a staff. It was just like magnificent. They were living life and every single possible luxury that you could ever imagine. Now let's talk about his wife, Nancy, okay? Nancy was a beautiful blonde bombshell, and she really liked to party. She also really enjoyed the finer things in life, obviously. And I gotta say, this is kind of ironic, but personality-wise, Nancy was a lot like Robert's older brother, Andrew. Almost kind of like she was the female version of him. For example, both Andrew and Nancy wanted to be professional artists. However, it didn't really work out for either one of them. So because of that, that's when Andrew got into the real estate development, when he started, you know, going off on buying all the high rises and doing his thing. Now for Nancy, professional artistry didn't work out for her either, but instead of harnessing that and going into her own business, she kind of found a new focus, which was living the high life, enjoying her husband's money, just kind of living all the luxuries that she possibly could. And when I say living the life of luxury, I truly, truly mean it. Her husband, Robert, was making over $3 million per year in bonuses alone. Not even including his salary, guys, just in bonuses. So they clearly had a lot of money to spend, to burn, to buy things with. So yeah, with that, there really was nothing wrong with Nancy enjoying a little shopping spree every now and then. I mean, they certainly could afford it. And it wasn't just the money. I mean, everyone who knew them, even their closest friends, agreed that Robert and Nancy seemed to have just a fantastic, loving, and great marriage. They would spend lots of quality time together. They would go on dates at the golf course. They would go to the health club together. They would, you know, go in these like relaxing Roman baths together and just truly connected as best friends and as husband and wife.
If you are in Parkview, you don't really have to go out. There's a kindergarten there. There's a big supermarket there. Two or three pools and tennis courts.
It's a little like being in a nice resort.
So everything seemed perfect for them. However, there was one little problem, one tiny little hang-up that Nancy and Robert didn't really see eye to eye on, and that was the fact that he traveled a lot. He just was not home very often, and Nancy did not like that. And it wasn't just these business trips that were bothering her. It was also these 16-hour days at the office, these endless meetings, the late nights, you know, all of the things, which it does suck to be in a relationship with someone who you hardly ever see. I'm sure, yes, the money is nice, and I'm sure you can't bring in that type of money either if you're not working and hustling and, you know, having all these endless meetings and working long hours. But at a certain point, you're making more than you're ever going to be able to spend anyway, right? So that big paycheck can sort of feel like it's just not worth it anymore. You're losing quality time with your wife, your kids, your family. What are the true priorities?
In the beginning, it's all very overwhelming and it's fantastic and it's a great city and you have a beautiful apartment. And then the husband ends up being away much more than he promised. And you spend many nights alone. She never told me about it. It's an expat community. People talk with each other. And if there are problems in a relationship and people hear of it, it's like wildfire.
They were very social. They were fun. Everything was always perfect.
Now, even with all of those drawbacks, Nancy still stuck it out. And it sounds to me, which I'm just speculating, but I think it is a safe thing to guess here. But to me, it seems like maybe Nancy realized that with marriage, sometimes you have to take the good with the bad, right? You have to make some sacrifices, and in exchange, you get other things. For her, even though Robert wasn't around as much as she wanted him to be, it was worth putting up with because she got to live the lavish lifestyle. She got to purchase anything and everything she wanted. And overall, the relationship and the dynamic was still pretty good. That is, of course, until 2003 rolled around, because that is when everything changed. In November of that year, Robert did something completely unexpected. He just vanished. This man who usually spent every single minute, every waking hour at the office, just suddenly wasn't coming into work. He wasn't calling his family. He just was like a ghost. He wasn't answering his phone. He missed important meetings. He blew off his lunch appointments. I mean, literally, he just vanished. Nancy could not make heads or tails of it. She told her closest friends that yes, they had had a terrible fight, but she said she didn't really want to dive into all of the details. She wanted to keep that a little bit private, which, to be fair, Nancy had always been pretty private about their marriage, so it wasn't all that surprising that she wanted to keep things vague. But she also didn't think that this fight was something that was so severe that he would just disappear over it. She didn't know what to do. She didn't know if she was overreacting, if he would turn up, or what was going on. So she decided not to even tell her kids the full truth of what was happening. In fact, she acted like everything was completely normal. She kept the household running smoothly. She and her staff, her house staff, just kind of went about their usual routines. You know, school, playdates, clubs, sports, the works. And over time, it almost kind of started to become and look like she almost couldn't care less that Robert had gone missing. Or at the very least, I mean, maybe she was just trying to keep up appearances and didn't want her friends knowing how worried she was, but it started to seem a little bit off.
She said to me, something terrible has happened. It's a family emergency. And I said, is there anything I can do? She said, no, don't come over. But she sounded distraught. She sounded very upset.
So Robert was off doing whatever he was doing, wherever he was, and Nancy was coping. And one of her favorite ways to deal with stress, which was no surprise to pretty much anyone, it was shopping. So Nancy, like she always did, grabbed her credit cards, grabbed her purse, and she hit the stores. Now, I will say that after Robert had been gone for a few days, thankfully Nancy did go to the police in Hong Kong. She ended up reporting him as missing because she knew that after a few days, something just was not quite right here. So right away, the police launched an investigation. They looked at Andrew's life, his business, his friends, I mean, anyone who might have a reason to either threaten him or hurt him. And they also were really thinking about whether or not someone had kidnapped or killed Andrew, but also about whether he may have not just disappeared voluntarily. Maybe he was having an affair. Maybe he made a bad investment and he was running away from that. I mean, the possibilities felt endless. Which also meant that the list of suspects was endless. If he did not disappear voluntarily, it really could have been anybody involved. However, one person that they definitely did not suspect was his brother Andrew. I mean, sure, yes, they did have their tensions over the years, all of that sibling rivalry that I had mentioned before. But first of all, Andrew, he lived half a world away in the United States. He was nowhere near Hong Kong. Plus, he was also having some issues of his own, some issues that kept him way too busy to worry about keeping up with Robert. See, Andrew had always been sort of interested in taking shortcuts. You know the kind, you know, the get-rich-quick kind of schemes. And basically, if there was ever a situation where it seemed like he could make an easy buck, Andrew was all in. But even though Andrew was, you know, all money, money, money all the time, he had another side to him too. A family side. He had a wife named Haley and two children with her. Now let's talk about Haley, because she was also very accomplished. She fit in so well with this whole, you know, Kissel family who were all about pushing yourself, being the best, doing the best. So much so that she had actually been an Olympic level skier at one point. She also spent some time working as a stock analyst before she got married. Haley was just super smart and came from the same world that the Kissel brothers came from. A world full of old family money. And remember earlier how I said that Nancy, Robert's wife, was a lot like Andrew? Well, Haley was basically the complete polar opposite of Nancy. She was very poised, very reserved, very quiet. And whenever she was out in public, people would just kind of take notice of her true elegance, her demeanor. She wasn't ever flashy or showy like Nancy was. She didn't spend a lot of money. She just was very, what's the word, you know, proper and old money, but classy and nice. And it's funny how the brothers, you know, total personality opposites, sort of ended up marrying the female versions of each other, right? I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's almost like they did like wife swap or something. And you know what? Now that I really do think about it, there was a Lifetime movie about this case, about these brothers. And you know who played Andrew? John Stamos, Uncle Jesse. I totally remember it now, although I don't remember the name.
What have you done?
I've made us money, Haley.
Money? That's it?
Yes. And to make money, you have to gamble. And to gamble, you have to take risks.
You've turned us
and
into pariahs.
And risks require nerves and guts.
Money.
But you wouldn't know anything about that, Haley, because you have no guts.
These are your family, Andrew. These are your children.
So back in 2002, you know, 1 year before Robert had completely just vanished, Andrew and Haley had owned a beautiful unit in one of the best buildings in New York, and they totally loved living there. This was like glitz, glamour, had every single fixture and furnishing you could imagine. I mean, this place was just luxurious. It was top tier. And after being there for a while, they decided that they loved it so much that owning just one unit, it wasn't enough for them. So they went ahead and they bought two more units in the same building. Then they knocked it all down and they combined all three of them into this like one supersized, beautiful, gigantic home. They absolutely loved it. Not only the finishes, the furnishings, all of that, but again, just the building itself. So as time went on, Andrew even became more involved in the building's operations. At one point, he was even elected treasurer of the co-op board, which, let's be honest, it kind of seemed like a really great fit. I mean, this guy knew money. He had worked with the top firms out there, like I mentioned, Merrill Lynch, you know, investment banking, all of the things. So everybody had figured that if he had gotten himself that rich, that he would also surely be able to handle all of the business finances, right? I mean, it was a no-brainer. However, when Andrew got into this position, something just sort of shifted. He didn't just see it as a responsibility. He also saw it as an opportunity. See, being the treasurer meant that he now had control over how the HOA fees from the residents were being spent. You know, when you pay into an HOA, if you're in a community, it goes to lawn maintenance, gate, upkeep, whatever it may be, paint, possibly. So now that he was the treasurer, he was able to really make those decisions. What are all of these HOA payments going toward? And I don't know the exact payment for his building, but I will say the HOAs in New York are insane. And it varies area to area, right? State to state. But let me just kind of level set for a minute. So I think right now in California, where I live, I think my HOA is, I want to say maybe like $200 a month, okay? Maybe $300. And that, no, I think it's $200. Or maybe it's two and some change. I don't know. It's something between two and three. I don't know the exact number. But anyway, that goes towards like the things I just mentioned, you know, upkeep, this and that, all the little things that go into an HOA. However, when I lived in New York, I wasn't paying an HOA because I didn't own in New York because it feels like impossible to own there. It's so expensive. However, the building I was renting in, I just got curious one day and I was like, what would it cost to buy one of these units? First of all, the apartment I was living in, it was going to cost me like $2 million to buy it, which, couldn't afford that. But then I looked at the HOA fees. The HOA on top of the mortgage was $1,700 a month. This was also back in 2019. I looked recently and it was like $2,700 a month. So that's money, which that's like a rent payment or a mortgage payment on its own, right? So like there is a lot of money in New York just going into these HOAs. And because you think about it too, unless you're living upstate or living in a brownstone, it's pretty much buildings that people live in. These really nice apartments, but buildings. So there is so much money just getting funneled through the HOA. And the reason I wanted to bring all of that up is to just kind of remind you as I'm talking about this, how much opportunity that was, because now Andrew was controlling all of the HOA that comes in every single month, all those fees. And not only that, but he was also responsible for how it's going to be distributed, where it's going to go, what they're going to use that money for. So it's a lot of money and it's a lot of responsibility. Even though that was a long-winded explanation, you get what I mean. So now he had a lot of freedom in how he managed things, what contractors he would hire, what he would pay for. And with power comes great responsibility, right? And this is where things started getting a little bit shady. So from the sound of things, Andrew had a lot of control as treasurer over how everything went down, and nobody really paid attention to what he was doing. They trusted him. They thought that he would make the right decisions. You know, why wouldn't he? He built incredible wealth on his own. Surely he knows how to manage money. So because nobody was paying close attention, it became really easy for him to order some work that needed to be done in the building and then skim a little bit off the top for himself. For example, at one point, the building needed to have its lobby and hallways renovated, and Andrew was the one who was collecting all of the quotes for different parts of the renovations, you know, looking at the different contractors, deciding who to hire, all of those different elements that go into it. And after he got all of that information together, he said that the total renovation would cost about $1 million. A pretty hefty price tag for like a hallway and a lobby, right? But here's the thing, once the work was finished, the people who lived in that building were not at all impressed. They had a certain idea in their minds of, you know, what a $1 million renovation would look like, what a $1 million hallway would look like. I mean, it should be like floor-to-ceiling marble, true 14-karat gold inside of it, right? I mean, that is so expensive. And what everybody was looking at kind of just frankly looked cheap. So they were all wondering how in the hell this renovation could have possibly cost as much as Andrew said that it did. Yet still, they trusted him. I mean, after all, he also lived in the building, just like them. He certainly didn't want to live in some crappy, cheap-looking building. Plus, he was their neighbor, maybe even their friend, so why would he ever lie to them? So nobody questioned it. And he got away with it. And that hallway and lobby project was just one scam that he ran, one of the many. I mean, Andrew was doing this over and over again with all kinds of different work projects in the building. And get this, over the course of his time as the co-op board treasurer, Andrew managed to steal millions, multiple millions, because he basically stole from every single project that he worked on. There wasn't a single renovation or a single repair that he handled in an honest way. He always skimmed money off the top. Now, what's so crazy to me in all of that, and maybe it's just an illustration of how much wealth is in New York, but how does somebody manage to skim multiple millions of dollars without anybody even noticing? That is so insane to me. I mean, that's like a life I want to be living, to where I can't even notice that money is missing. Like, can you imagine? Can you imagine? Which that's what, like, honestly kills me about these cases that we talk about, because it's like you literally had everything in the world you could possibly want. And I say that loosely. Everybody has issues, right? Money doesn't buy happiness. But like, that's a lot of money. I think that could buy a lot of happiness for somebody. So to throw it all away, it's just, I never will understand it. Now, what I will say is that eventually, even though it took a while, the board did notice that there was some money missing, and they did end up tracking everything back to Andrew. And when they did, he kind of just fessed up, but he also begged them to not go to the police. He said, you know, I'm sorry, I have a family. You can't do this to me. We're friends. I'm so sorry. I promise I'll pay it back. I was just like stuck in a bind. It'll never happen again. And because he was begging and pulling the friend card and acting so sorry and remorseful, it's pretty wild, but it worked. The board actually agreed not to press charges against Andrew. They agreed to just let him off the hook as long as he eventually paid the money back. So that's what he did.
He stole money. That was something that he didn't seem able to control. He wanted a bigger car. He wanted a bigger boat. He wanted to be out in front. He was the worst thing that ever happened to his investors and to people that trusted him with money.
So I know that that was a lot about Andrew, and we were talking about Robert's vanishing act, but I do think it's important to cover all of the background just so that you can get true context as to who we're talking about. And it shows you what Andrew was truly up to. He wasn't exactly an honest or ethical person, but he also had never done anything violent. So that takes us back full circle as to why he was not a suspect in his brother Robert's disappearance. And even more than that, when his younger brother Robert went missing, the assumption was that Andrew was just too busy with his own financial problems to have anything to do with the disappearance. So instead, the police started their investigation at the last place that Robert had been seen, his apartment. And right away, they noticed that something was off. There was this strange, almost sour smell that was super, super intense. But as they kept looking through the apartment, nothing particularly alarming jumped out at them. At least, not right away. But it's helpful to keep in mind that the search actually did take a really long time, which honestly probably shouldn't be that surprising because I talked about how luxurious this apartment complex was, right? I mean, it was massive. On top of all of the other glamorous features that were within it, there was also a ton of extra storage, you know, a ton of room, including an extra storage area somewhere else entirely in the building. So of course, because of that, the police wanted to search that area too, and they wanted to see what they could find, if anything, inside of it. Well, as it turns out, right away, they saw boxes of things that looked like they could have belonged to Robert, almost things like clothing. However, they had blood all over them. And remember the smell that those officers had noticed inside their apartment? Well, there was that same odor in this new area. The only difference was, it was 10 times worse in this area. The place just reeked. So finally, after the police sorted through the stuff in the bloodstained boxes, they noticed that there was a rolled-up rug, like a rolled-up carpet-style rug, in the back corner. And I'm sure a lot of people's minds are going to a worst-case kind of direction right now. We know this is not a good sign. If you've got a bad odor, a rolled-up rug, pretty safe bet that there's a body inside of it, right? And sure enough, when the cops pulled that carpet out and unrolled it, Robert's body was stuffed inside. And not only that, it looked like he had been dead for days. Even more, his skull was completely bashed in, which, let's just be real, that would have taken some effort because Robert was a pretty big guy. So whoever had done this to him, it had to be somebody who was incredibly strong. It was also very clear that this was intentional. He didn't say, you know, trip and fall and hit his head badly and then somebody tried to cover it up because it was an accident. In fact, even before the police were able to order an autopsy, they could just tell by looking at his head injuries that he had been bludgeoned to death. But the question, of course, in all of this was, who would have done this? Who would want Robert dead? One early theory was that Robert got wrapped up in some sort of bad deal at some point. I mean, the business decisions that he was making were all for like millions and millions of dollars. So it was all very high risk, high reward, that kind of situation. So if, say, Robert somewhere along the way maybe pissed off the wrong person or lost too much money and somebody was angry about that, could they have decided to take matters into their own hands? I mean, it wouldn't be the first time where we've heard a story where business matters became personal very, very quickly. Another similar theory was that maybe Robert had gotten mixed up in the wrong crowd. Because again, he was dealing with huge amounts of money, I mean millions of dollars. So when you're making these power moves, it's not hard or difficult to get wrapped up in different shady groups or even possibly organized crime groups. He did have ties back to New York and Jersey as well, so was there some sort of connection there? So the next theory that went was kind of like, you know, even if Robert hadn't lost anybody's money and he did everything exactly right, he might have just been involved with the wrong sort of people. And because of that, it could have just put a target on his back. So basically, there were a ton of possibilities. It really was endless. And this next part might be pretty shocking to hear, but just 2 hours after his body was found, at 2:41 a.m. on November 7th, 2003, the police arrested his wife, Nancy, for his murder. And if you're wondering, okay, how did the police manage to solve this case so quickly after, you know, a whole whopping 120 minutes when they had no idea how he had vanished, who was responsible, anything that was really, you know, included in a true investigation? Well, it's because Nancy, his wife, did a really piss poor job covering her tracks. I mean, clearly she had absolutely no idea what she was doing when it came to getting away with murder, which, you know it. I love to see it. I love to see when this happens. Now, remember that weird smell that I mentioned inside the apartment? Not even the storage area, but inside the actual unit? Well, it turns out that Nancy had been sleeping in the same bed as Robert's corpse for days after he was killed. Literally, right there in bed with his body, sleeping next to him. And remember that shopping trip that she went on to, you know, cope with him disappearing and him missing because shopping was how she always dealt with her stress? Well, she wasn't just out buying new outfits or new jewelry. This shopping trip was very specific because one of the things that she purchased was a rug. She also picked up some cleaning supplies and all of the things that she would need to really clean up after her husband's murder. Then she went home. She told all of her house staff, her maids, her housekeepers, everybody, nobody is allowed to set foot in my bedroom under any circumstance. In fact, the entire time that Robert was missing, nobody was allowed in that bedroom. And as it turns out, it's because she had a lot of cleaning up to do. See, the police believed that Nancy had actually smashed Robert's skull in with this really heavy metal sculpture. Something from their own home, something they had collected, something that was probably sitting right there out on their mantle. Now, you also might be thinking, okay, well, Annie, you said that he was bludgeoned so bad that it had to be somebody incredibly strong, somebody with a lot of force behind it. And it's not like Nancy was like some bodybuilder or super buff, right? Well, apparently, she was able to take her time and not worry too much about him fighting back or getting away from her. And that's because, according to the investigators, Nancy had drugged Robert on the night that she killed him. More specifically, she made Robert a milkshake, acting like she was this kind, caring wife doing something sweet for her husband. All the while, though, he didn't even realize that she had put sedatives inside of it. And here's where it gets even more messed up, if you can believe it. Nancy didn't serve Robert this, you know, drugged milkshake all by herself. In fact, she had her 6-year-old daughter deliver it to him, knowing he would never turn down something that his 6-year-old daughter gave to him. I mean, obviously, he wouldn't want his own little girl to feel bad, so here she comes in saying, "Daddy, Daddy, I made you a milkshake. This is for you." Of course, he's going to be like, "Oh my gosh, thank you, sweetie." And whether he drinks the whole thing or a couple sips, he would never suspect anything weird about that. But that was all part of Nancy's plan. She wanted to elicit this, you know, whatever it would be, this innocent type move on her daughter and prey on her daughter's innocence, in my opinion, to deliver this milkshake that would put him incapacitated to where then she could, you know, execute her sinister plan. And in fact, Robert's neighbor Andrew, not to be confused with his brother Andrew, was actually over at their apartment when this all went down. His daughter had been playing with Robert's daughter, and he actually drank some of that milkshake too. And he later said that he felt a little bit weird and a little bit groggy for the rest of the night. He even said that his wife could tell that something was off with him, almost like he was, you know, mentally in another world and could barely interact with her. Which, think about that, if he only had a couple of sips and that's how he was acting and what his wife noticed, then how was Robert doing? How out of it was he? I guess it didn't really matter though how he was doing, because not long after he completely just passed out, Nancy bashed Robert's head in, literally bashed his brains in with this heavy metal sculpture. And when everything was done, the entire bedroom was completely drenched in blood. It was on everything, so much so that she needed to buy new bedding, she needed to scrub the walls, she needed to scrub the floors. It was, by definition, a bloodbath. And apparently there was so much stuff in the room that was also covered in blood that she had to, like, replace things, buy new things. She had to even order packing boxes from a moving company to move things around, trying to, like, cover up and conceal this crime scene. But you think about that, and then the fact that she crawled into the bed with him for days after this. Talk about unhinged and diabolical, right? I mean, that is horrific. So eventually, Nancy allegedly rolled Robert's body up into that rug, and then she called some maintenance men from the complex that they lived at to help her move it. She literally had the men come inside their apartment and unknowingly help her cover up the murder. Now, I do have to wonder if any of these guys noticed that there was anything off about this, right? I mean, maybe they smelled the cleaning supplies. Maybe when they picked the rug up, they felt the weight of it. I mean, wouldn't you feel, I guess not if it's like, if it's rolled with multiple layers, but like, wouldn't you feel like the shoulders, the feet, something like that? I don't know. Maybe I would have to imagine that a carpet feels different with a corpse inside of it than if it's just rolled up on its own, but I don't know. What do I know? But also, if you just murdered somebody and then you roll their body into a rug, are you really okay with just taking that risk and having other people move it for you? That seems really bold to me, like a huge, huge risk. What if the body falls out? What if they smell it? What if they can tell that the shape of it is off? I guess she had no choice though, right? She's not strong, so what else are you going to do in that situation? However, despite who did or did not notice what was going on, apparently one of the maids did notice that the carpet seemed unusually bulky, like it wasn't just rolled up fabric. However, when they inquired about it, Nancy just told them that it was stuffed with pillows and blankets. So once Nancy had Robert's body taken care of, her next step was to find a way to cover her tracks. And I don't know what her long-term goal was here, if she had any idea of how to dispose of this body permanently or what. But it also sounds like she was already starting to prepare a defense for this, trying to make it sound like the killing was justified. Because at one point while Robert was still missing, Nancy went to go see a family doctor. And when she did, she claimed that her husband had assaulted her. According to her, he had been drinking at home and he had, quote, kicked and grabbed her. She was crying the entire time, and she also did actually have bruises to show the doctor. They wrote in their documents that the bruises were on her shoulder, her hand, and that she was visibly upset and in pain. Now, before I move on, I do want to just be clear about one thing here. There is a lot of controversy around this next part because some people believe that Nancy was being sincere and she was being truthful when she went to that doctor and disclosed what had happened, that she really was being hurt by Robert and that she killed him because it was the only way that she could get away from him. And many people think it's the real motive and why she really murdered her husband, Robert. So one of the other possible motives that came out in all of this, and what many people suggest is the real motive, is that a year before Robert's murder, so back in 2002, there was a pretty serious pandemic in Asia. It was the SARS outbreak. And you might remember hearing about it on the news if you're old enough, but things were apparently bad enough that Nancy just did not feel safe staying in Hong Kong. So because of that, she took the kids with her back to the States for a few months. They all stayed in Vermont in this beautiful home that Robert had bought for the family, which must be nice, right? To be able to buy an entire house just for a visit, just for vacation because there's an outbreak. But Nancy had really big plans for this house, and she eventually wanted to live in this house full time. So because of that, she wanted to make it nice. She wanted to do renovations. She wanted to get it up to her standards. She wanted to just make it her home. So as she was getting all of the potential renovations in order, she hired an electrician named Michael Del Priore. Michael was going to come and do some work around the house. And Michael very much wasn't the sort of person who Nancy usually spent a lot of time around. I mean, he wasn't rich. He didn't live the high life. He didn't usually rub elbows with that kind of crowd. In fact, he lived in a trailer and he had a super laid-back attitude. So he was night and day different from Robert, who, you'll remember, was this wealthy workaholic. Well, for whatever reason, there was an immediate spark between the two of them. Nancy enjoyed Michael's company, she liked being around him, and when she found out that he had a daughter, she even offered to set up a play date with her own kids. So things first started with more of a business relationship, with Michael doing work for Nancy. Then they became friends. But then, in a real, you know, opposites attract kind of situation, they started having an affair. A tale as old as time, right? So Nancy was basically having her cake and eating it too, sneaking around with Michael right under Robert's nose, no less in a house that her husband Robert had purchased for her. And apparently Nancy wasn't very good at covering her tracks, not only with murder, but also with having an affair. I'm not exactly sure what she did or what she said that tipped her husband off, but eventually Robert started to get suspicious, so much so that he hired a private investigator to start following Nancy around. So of course, this investigator figured out what was going on, and then he took that news back to Robert. According to the PI, Robert had every intention of divorcing Nancy over this. However, before he could let her know what he knew or let her know that a divorce was coming, he felt like he needed to get all of his ducks in a row. So he talked to a whole bunch of different super powerful lawyers, basically got her blacklisted from all the biggest, most powerful legal firms, and he got to work putting together his exit strategy. Now, apparently, it's a norm in the legal field in Hong Kong that if you consult with someone about a divorce once, even if they don't hire you, you're not allowed to work with the other spouse. And I've also heard that, I don't know if it's statewide, correct me if you know the answer, I've heard of that taking place here in the States as well, that if you hire someone, say even as a retainer or for a dollar or whatever it is, to consult with them about a divorce, even if you don't hire them, your spouse cannot hire them, that it's some sort of conflict of interest type thing. So Robert went out and booked all of these consultations specifically to make sure that Nancy wouldn't be able to get one of the top tier lawyers when he was ready to pull the trigger and serve her with the divorce papers. Which, I gotta say, is kind of an asshole move, but it's also kind of a genius move. If you're wanting to protect your money and your assets and from your cheating spouse or your cheating wife, I understand going to all of the, like, top lawyers and basically saying, well, I'm going to pull all these resources away from you. Better luck next time, pal. Find someone new. It sucks, but it also is pretty smart. I don't know. So to summarize, Robert was all poised to end the marriage and to make sure that Nancy did not receive a single thing. Or if not nothing, at the very least, she would not do well in the divorce court. He wanted to make sure that she wouldn't be able to get good representation. I mean, she cheated on him. He had the proof. So she was probably going to end up with not a lot. But what Robert didn't realize during all of this was that Nancy was also making plans. Nancy wasn't satisfied to just divorce Robert to leave him and then go live and ride off into the sunset with Michael in the trailer park. She wasn't about to give up the life of luxury. But from what I can tell, she also had no idea about what Robert was even up to. She had no idea that he found out or that he was planning to divorce her. Yet she was already thinking two steps ahead, being like, I want to leave him, but I don't want to leave my financial situation. And that's the motive that everybody believes was the true motive in all of this. That she wanted to be with Michael, yet she wanted to keep all of Robert's money. And that's why some people believe that she killed him over it. Some even suggested that those bruises and those marks on her body when she went to the doctor were at the hands not of herself, but of her boyfriend Michael, all to make it look like she really was battered and had been abused. So it took almost 2 years for Nancy to go to trial for Robert's murder. It happened in 2005, and it was headline news all over Asia, particularly in Hong Kong, where the murder had happened. And looking back, it was basically like their version of the Idaho murders, or even the Chris Watts case, right, to what that is in the United States. I mean, every single new development, it was in the papers, it was on the news, it was wherever you could see it, not really social media at the time, but you get it. Any outlet that could talk about it was talking about it. And it was all that anybody in the public was talking about too. Now, by the time the trial started, Nancy had completely changed her look. She was now dressing super modest. She dyed her hair to be darker. She was wearing glasses. It felt very much like a page from the Jodi Arias case. And I don't remember thinking back to it now who came first, Nancy or Jodi. But remember, Jodi did this too. She dyed her hair dark. She put on the glasses. She started speaking in like a very quiet, meek type way. So maybe Nancy wanted to be less recognizable. Maybe she wanted to look like a humble wife instead of the type who was a party woman, wealthy, wearing designer labels and having blonde bombshell hair. Who really knows? But whatever the reason was, she definitely looked different.
Nancy Kissel was always dressed in black, a typical widow look, as it were. I think it really hit home with a lot of the people in Hong Kong. It was a glimpse of a world that they're not used to.
Now, even though she pleaded not guilty, when her cross-examination started, Nancy admitted, point blank, that she had killed her husband. At first, it was shocking, but it also made sense because she was claiming self-defense, which fit with that visit that she had made to the doctor about Robert allegedly hitting her. And according to Nancy's testimony, Robert was this alcoholic, this rage-fueled drug addict, and he had abused her for years, including sexually assaulting her. But she painted him in a very negative light.
She really thought he was going to kill her, that he had a bad temper. There was a huge argument. He came at her with a baseball bat. There was a struggle. He turns her around, and it's at this point that she just swings back, and he kind of sits back and looks at the blood and says, "You bitch." And then at that point, charges at her with a baseball bat. "I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you." And she said, then she just blanks out.
She blanks out.
She can't remember.
Nancy also testified, which I gotta say, kind of threw me for a loop with this, but she also testified that the night of the murder wasn't the first time that she had ever tried to drug Robert either. Apparently, when they were in Vermont at one point, she had also put sedatives in his whiskey. According to her, she wasn't trying to kill him back then when she did that, but she was worried about the way that he was acting around the children. She says he was aggressive. And Nancy claimed that by drugging him, it really was the only way and the only thing that she could think of to get him to just like chill out and behave better. She also said that she did the same thing at one point while they were living in Hong Kong. But then after that, she ended up dumping out the bottle and never even thought about it again. Except, of course, you know, for the night that she ended up, you know, murdering him. But even with that story, and honestly, quite a bunch of people who were on her side and believed her, it only took the jury 8 hours to reach their decision. Nancy was guilty, and her sentence was life in prison. But this was far from over. Now, after Robert's murder, and with Nancy now in prison for the rest of her life, their kids needed a place to live, right? So after the trial ended in 2005, Robert's brother Andrew and his wife Haley took all of these kids in with no questions asked. I mean, obviously they would do anything for their nieces and nephews. And it also probably didn't hurt that they were going to be inheriting Robert's entire estate, which, by the way, was worth $18 million. Now, in theory, you would think that Andrew and Haley wouldn't care at all about his brother's money. Even with Andrew's history of scamming, he wouldn't want to steal from his own brother and his own brother's children, right? Especially after Robert was brutally murdered, right? Well, as it turns out, the money that Andrew had taken from his building's co-op, it was just the tip of the iceberg. The whole time that he had been doing his supposed real estate work, you know, supposedly making tons of money with these brilliant business deals, he was actually ripping people off. He filed multiple mortgages and remortgages on huge properties, forging signatures, saying that his loans were paid off when they definitely weren't. And then he just shuffled the money around to fund his next scam. One of Andrew's scams included going to multiple banks and getting mortgages on the same property at all of them. So each bank thought that they were the only one giving him the money. But actually, he was collecting a bunch of different loans all at once. And while that's super illegal, it was a lot easier to pull off in the mid-2000s than it would be today. Back then, banks didn't have the same fraud alert systems that they do now. And honestly, it sounds like they weren't really looking too hard either because they wanted his business so badly, they just kind of made it work. But the crazy thing is, Andrew kept doing this over and over and making, or I guess I should say stealing, millions of dollars in the process. He did this so many times and on such massive properties So much so that this money was really starting to stack up. And he was able to get away with all of it because he basically dressed well, he knew the right people. Remember, he knew how to like grease the elbows and talk to people and be super charming. So they all assumed that they could just trust him. But eventually, he got caught. Because he got sloppy. Actually, he was kind of always sloppy. It just took a while for somebody to finally take notice. But it turns out that Andrew was using the same notary signature stamp on the paperwork for every single one of these mortgage deals. And it said that the notary was a notary in Connecticut. So at first, no one really noticed because, you know, using the same notary isn't that weird if you're doing all of your deals in the same area. But Andrew wasn't. He was operating in a bunch of different states, some of which were nowhere near Connecticut. And eventually, some of his business partners started to wonder why he would go all the way to Connecticut just to notarize their documents when he could take care of it with somebody who was local. And it was actually a real estate lawyer who noticed something fishy for the very first time. She was going through some of his paperwork, just kind of like rifling through, when she noticed the same notary stamp just popping up again and again. So because of that, she decided to dig a little bit deeper. And as it turned out, Andrew had never gone to a notary at all, not even this fake Connecticut one. It turns out he had stolen the stamp from the actual notary, and then he had been using it to make all of these fake documents look legit.
Because the first transaction was unusual in that a mortgage showed up at the last minute that shouldn't have been there. When the second transaction came up, and initially there was no mortgage on the record, then there was a mortgage, we ultimately obtained copies of all of the releases in the two chains of title on these properties and noticed that there were the same notary used for multiple banks, mm-hmm. which is impossible.
Sure. Had you ever seen anything like this before in your experience?
Never. Not in this extent.
What was the first thing you did when you realized that something was wrong?
Well, I contacted his attorney and I said, there's a problem here. I had called one of the banks that supposedly had released the mortgage, and they said, oh, the mortgage is alive and well, and the balance is $5 million and change. And I called his attorney, and I said, we have a problem here. We cannot go ahead and fund this loan. It was going to be a new loan of $6 or $7 million. And he communicated then with Mr. Kissel, who ultimately said to him, well, just pay it off, mm-hmm. and because there was going to be enough money from this closing. And I said, no, we're not going to pay it off. The closing is adjourned.
So it's probably no surprise that by March of 2006, Andrew and his wife were behind on rent, and it was now looking more and more likely like they were going to lose their home entirely. Haley and Andrew's marriage wasn't doing very great by that point either, and it was looking like Haley wanted out. She had sort of gotten sick of all of Andrew's lying and scheming, and because of that, this was a huge blow to Andrew. His mental health was taking a pretty big beating. It seemed like he was sort of broken, beaten down, and almost like the walls were finally closing in on him. And remember that whole mortgage fraud scheme? It was so bad that the FBI got involved with it, and they had all of the evidence that they needed to prove exactly what he was doing. So, he was officially charged with $25 million worth of fraud in three different states. There was no escape. There was no getting away from these consequences this time. So, Andrew accepted a plea deal that would have him serve 8 to 10 years in prison. However, he never made it to court to formally offer the plea. Because just a few days before he was supposed to show up on April 3rd, Andrew was found dead inside his own home. He had been stabbed to death. And he was left behind in a pool of his own blood. So Andrew was now found inside his home, stabbed to death. His body was found by some movers that he and his wife Haley had hired. They were supposed to move out of their home that day and be out for good. And the movers were supposed to pack up the last few things that were still inside. But instead, they found Andrew in his basement, tied up with zip ties and duct tape and, of course, stabbed multiple times. The scene was insanely messy and just violent, which made it seem very personal. It was clear that this wasn't some sort of random break-in gone wrong. But who would want him dead? Well, there are a couple of theories. The first was that Andrew might have taken his own life and then staged it to look like a murder. I mean, he was definitely not in a good place, emotionally or mentally, when he died. Definitely not. He was about to go to prison. And on top of that, he had spent his entire adult life trying to seem like a success, like he was super accomplished. And now he was completely exposed as a fraud. So maybe that left him feeling like he had no good options except to die. Except, of course, it's pretty hard to stab yourself to death multiple times. At a certain point, you would be hurt enough or you would hit, you know, the wrong artery enough that you would have lost enough blood that you wouldn't be able to keep driving the knife in. I mean, unless you're Ellen Greenberg and people think that she did that, which that's a whole, if you haven't heard that case, I'll link it in the show notes, but people actually believe it's a suicide, which is insane to me. But what I mean by that is, if you're stabbing yourself multiple times, at one point, you're going to be too weak to continue, or you're going to hit something that's going to paralyze you or create massive blood loss, something. So that, not to mention the fact that his hands were zip-tied together, literally. I mean, it would have been absolutely almost impossible for Andrew to kill himself this specific way. Not unless, of course, he had help. So another thought and another theory was that Andrew might have taken out a hit on himself, had other people do it, but he was still the one responsible for the plan of it all. Because again, maybe he didn't want to go to prison, maybe he didn't want to face the music, maybe he didn't see any other way out except for death, but also, most likely because he didn't want his children to know that he had died at his own hands. So people think he arranged his murder, basically all for his family's peace of mind. Some people also suggested that it could have been almost like an Aaron Hernandez type situation where he wanted to, and this is all alleged with Aaron, but where Andrew might have wanted to stage it as a murder rather than him being the one who planned it so that the financial element would be protected, so that his family would get the life insurance policy, that they would still be financially taken care of. So it seemed to make sense, and the cops entertained that theory for a while. But ultimately, they just felt like it wasn't right. It sounded way too elaborate. And frankly, even if that theory was true and Andrew had gotten himself murdered, that is still a crime. It's not like you get a get out of jail free card for somebody murdering you if you hire someone to kill you. Like, it just doesn't make sense. So either way, whatever the motive was, this case, it still needed to be solved. Especially because with all of the people that Andrew had ripped off over the years, the suspect list, it was very long.
So, Ann Bramner?
Yeah, I look at this case, Nancy, the Kissel of death. Where did it come from? Anywhere, the
okay,
mob.
That's bad.
I know, but I had to say it. But the mob, the hookers, the dopers, everyone he swindled, his neighbors, his friends, his business associates, strangers in business. You know, everybody, who did not want to kill him? Raise your hand. Oh, everyone wanted to kill him that he knew. You know, everyone's a suspect. Nobody's a suspect. Nancy, everyone's a suspect, and everyone's a suspect that knows this guy.
The investigation went on for years. But in 2008, the police finally zeroed in on a suspect in Andrew's murder. It began with a routine search, since the investigators didn't have any real leads to go off of. They were kind of just like looking at his friends, his family members, his employees, everyone. And at one point, they searched the home of his chauffeur. His chauffeur's name was Carlos Trujillo. Now, this search was about a year after the murder, so around 2007. And when they searched, the investigators didn't find anything very interesting or notable. I mean, at least nothing that stuck out as notable at first. They did, however, find a credit card that was not in Carlos's name. It was for somebody else. Their name was Aminta Trujillo. Now, at first, this didn't really set off any red flags. I mean, this Aminta person, whoever she was, had the same last name as Carlos. So maybe it was a family member, a spouse, who really knows? I mean, a little weird for him to have a credit card for somebody else, yes, but maybe they loaned it to him, left it behind, maybe it fell out of their wallet, who knows? Whatever the story may be, not a huge red flag. So the police basically wrote up their report saying that they hadn't found anything interesting, but they also did mention Aminta's name in their report, saying that the credit card was found at Carlos's house and they didn't know who she was. Seemed like no big deal. Except then, more weeks and months went by. And still, they didn't have any breaks in the case. They still had no idea who murdered Andrew. And with literally no other leads to go off of, the police decided to start following up on some of the more out there theories, the long shot theories. And this ended up being a good idea because Aminta was, which let me just get this right, she was Carlos's cousin's half-sister. Carlos's cousin was named Leonard. and Leonard was Aminta's half-brother. So anyway, the police brought Aminta in for questioning, and right off the bat, she was very nervous. She definitely seemed like she had something to hide. She didn't know what the interrogation was about yet, and the investigators hadn't said a word to her about Andrew's murder, but it was obvious that she was nervous, and she felt like she needed to get something off of her chest. So the investigators asked Aminta if she knew why they wanted to talk to her. And at first, she was sort of like, well, it's because we're involved with the cartels, right? Which, no, that's not right. So eventually, the police let her know that they wanted to know who had killed Andrew. And it was almost like this huge weight was just lifted off her shoulders. She seemed way more relaxed, way more comfortable. And she told the police very kind of casually and calmly, like, oh yeah, of course, my half-brother Leonard had killed Andrew, along with Carlos and another of Carlos's cousin, Jair, which was a bizarre revelation in and of itself, because whatever this family was apparently doing with the cartels, it was serious enough and violent enough that in Aminta's mind, one single murder was like small time. Like, oh yeah, let me just tell you, let me just get it off my chest. And she was nervous about something completely unrelated. It's almost as though she thought she was getting off easy by admitting to this like one smaller, more minor crime, which I can only imagine what had her so nervous at the start of that interrogation in comparison, and I don't want to go near that. So as it turned out, this family had all been pretty heavily involved with Andrew's scams and all of his, you know, scheming and pyramid scheming, whatever it was. They had been laundering his money for him. And when the authorities started investigating Andrew, and then when he struck his deal, that made Carlos and the other people who were involved feel really nervous, like he was going to flip on them and share some names. More specifically, they were afraid that not only would Andrew name them, but name them as collaborators, and then they would all get arrested as well. So, rather than risk going to jail for financial crimes, they decided to commit a much more serious crime, and they decided to murder Andrew. Carlos was charged with both murder and attempted murder, but he was acquitted of the murder charge. Apparently, the jury just did not think that there was enough hard evidence to prove that Carlos was the one who did it. But the attempted murder charge, it didn't go so smoothly. The jury was deadlocked, unable to reach a decision. So the judge had to declare a mistrial on that count. In the end, Carlos decided to take a deal. He pleaded guilty to the attempted murder charge, and he was sentenced to 6 years in prison, minus time served. Once he served his time, he was deported back to his home country in Colombia. Now, as for the cousin Leonard, he took a plea deal. He admitted to manslaughter and conspiracy to commit murder. He also agreed to testify against Carlos. So for all of that, he was sentenced to 20 years in prison. It's not entirely clear to me what happened with the other cousin. I've done a lot of research and I don't see any sign that he was ever taken to court or convicted of anything. So I don't know if that means that the police ended up deciding that maybe they didn't have a strong enough case against him, or if maybe there was some other factor at play there. I don't know. But either way, now you have these two brothers who had always competed against each other their whole lives, but who really, arguably, had everything at their fingertips. But now, they were both murdered by people who they knew and people who they trusted. Now, going back to Robert and his wife, Nancy, she is still in prison, but she has certainly tried to file every appeal that she can think of. Her lawyers argue that her trial was unfair because, according to them, there were issues with how the evidence was handled and the jury didn't get the full picture. And in 2010, after 5 years in prison, Nancy managed to actually get her conviction overturned on an appeal. The court ruled that there had been procedural errors in her original trial, and that gave her a chance at a retrial in 2011. During the retrial, the arguments were basically the same. Nancy and her lawyers still said that she had killed Robert in self-defense, and the prosecution still said that she was just greedy, that she wanted to get out of this marriage while still getting her hands on Robert's money. And once again, the jury found Nancy guilty of murder. So, she was sentenced to life in prison for a second time. And here's what her mom and her stepdad had to say after the sentencing.
Make sure that Nan gets medical, physical, and psychological help from professionals, because she won't survive if she doesn't.
Shocked at the outcome. Can't conceive of the mindset of the jurors that could listen to that evidence for 10 weeks and come away with that belief. Just can't even comprehend that. But all in all, I think it was a fair trial.
Now get this. Apparently, for years after the murder, Nancy stayed in touch with Michael, the electrician, the handyman, the man that she had this affair with. Every single day, she would write to him, and these letters were multiple pages long, sometimes five full pages of just, like, love letters to him, which I can't imagine what was going on in prison that was worth writing five pages over, but she did it every single day. Eventually, Michael started seeing somebody new, though, and then he got married, but that didn't stop these letters from coming through. It was almost like Nancy was obsessive, and also, if I'm being honest, kind of a little out of touch with reality. I've done quite a bit of research and I haven't seen anything about her being diagnosed with any kind of mental health condition, but between what went on with her and Michael and the comment that her mother made in that interview about needing mental health treatment, I do wonder if through all of this, maybe Nancy was dealing with some type of issues around, you know, delusion or some other problem. I don't know. Maybe I'm also reading too much into a few details. I don't know. It's hard to say. Whatever was going on with Nancy, though, it is wild to think about murder striking the same family twice for completely unrelated reasons. I mean, what an absolute tragedy. Now, the good news is that from what I can tell in my research, Robert's kids are okay. Apparently, the one surviving sibling, Jane, got custody of them after Andrew's murder. And ever since then, they have been living what I hope is a very quiet, safe, and happy life, you know, away from all of this trauma and all of this violence. The Kissel family's murder story is a brutal reminder that you never know what is happening behind closed doors, even in what can seem to be the most perfect lives. It's all Instagram filter, social media these days, right? So you never know what truly is happening. And more than that, you never know what's real. You don't know if somebody has it made. You don't know if they're super happy in their marriage. You don't know what struggles somebody is facing. So even though it can be really easy for us to compare our lives to other people, whether it's a family member, a friend, or a stranger on the internet, this is just a reminder that you don't really know the full picture. And chances are, in a lot of the situations, you are probably way better off than a lot of the people that you're idolizing. So just take what you see with a grain of salt. The wealth, the success, the insane houses, it didn't protect Andrew and Robert from the super dark realities of greed and betrayal. It doesn't really protect anybody, ever, right? So, I don't know. Food for thought, guys. That's me on my soapbox for my little outro there. Just don't compare yourself to other people because you never really know what the reality is. All right, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode with me. I'm going to go watch that Lifetime movie because I know I've already seen it, but I want to watch it again now. I just want to watch it back. And who's the actress that's in it? Who is it? I think I'm probably wrong, but I want to say it's the girl from Bridesmaids. Why can't I think of her name? The brunette one. What's her name in Bridesmaids? You know, the one who's like super prim and proper and who, I can't think of her name. I think that's her. I think I'm wrong, actually. No, I think it's the girl from The Craft, now that I think about it. Way off. Anyway, I'm going to go watch that. Let me know if you guys have seen that too. This case was wild, but thanks for tuning in with me. I'll be back on the mic with you first thing on Thursday with Headline Highlights, where we are breaking down everything happening this week in true crime. Don't miss it. And then I'll be back with you for the deep dive Monday. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in. Until the next one, just get a divorce. Be nice. Don't kill people. Don't join any cults, and just be a good human. All right. All right. Bye, guys.